KALW.
There's something really special about butterflies that are only found here or only found in this county.
Endangered butterflies saved San Bruno Mountain from development.
We thought, hey, this is a miracle. Number one, we saved the mountain. Now butterflies are going to save the mountain. They're going to stop the builders.
Today, we'll hear about preservation of the big and tiny. Then we'll visit a place that collects creepy crawlies and puts them on display.
When you take the time to look at them individually, you'll find they're extremely bizarre.
And three local authors read their writings about nature.
It's about one of the most important rivalries in history, a rivalry that shaped the nature of our relationship to the natural world, to nature itself.
A collection from our pocket-sized book tour, New Arrivals. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. 50 years ago, developers planned to flatten the top of San Bruno Mountain, dump 350 million cubic yards of rock into the bay, and build a housing development. That was until a movement to preserve the land and protect multiple endangered species halted most construction. So what can the story of San Bruno Mountain tell us about the relationship between environmentalism and housing? Reporter Julia Haney went looking for answers by first looking for insects.
We have coyotes, brush rabbits, a variety of snakes, and then, of course, our very unique insects.
That's Evan Cole, the natural resource manager for San Mateo County Parks.
They're also just, they're not very strong flyers, and they're very cryptic looking.
And today, he's searching for the elusive San Bruno elfin butterfly. It's his job to count the endangered butterflies here at San Bruno Mountain in Brisbane. He tracks how their populations are doing. But elfin can be hard to find in the scrubby brush.
They don't look as obviously charming as the Mission Blue butterfly.
The Mission Blue is electric blue. The elfin is small and brown, kind of like a moth. So it blends in. But in its caterpillar form, which is how we'll see it today, it's lipstick red, juicy, and beautiful. The Parks Department counts them every 2 years. So today, we're on a quest.
Let's look for some sedum.
The sedum is the succulent host plant for the caterpillars. Evan and his team construct circular plots around its habitat and count as many as they can find. These counts help them estimate the mountain's overall population. We're up at Dairy Ravine Trail on San Bruno Mountain. It slopes into wildland on one side and a bustling Guadalupe Canyon Parkway on the other.
This is maybe our most unhidden hidden gem of a park, with everybody driving by it between SFO and San Francisco. And actually, this is where the final car chase in the 1960s movie Bullet was filmed with Steve McQueen.
San Bruno Mountain has played many roles beyond its cinematic one. The Ohlone people, who have lived in Northern California coastal areas for thousands of years, once called the valleys of San Bruno Mountain home. After Europeans arrived and displaced them, the land was ranched with cattle. Today, there's a major highway in front of us, planes flying overhead, and radio and broadcast towers rising out of the land. But it's a surprising oasis, home to swaths of birds, endangered plants, and insects.
Learning these different species, I feel like, adds a lot of color to your day-to-day life, because you start to open your eyes to this whole community around you. That wasn't previously apparent to you. And I think that's kind of the way it is with butterflies. There's something really special about butterflies that are only found here or only found in this county.
Evan says the elfin is a jewel of the mountain, the way the mountain is a jewel of the county.
It's become restricted by all this development, but it's still holding its ground, and there's a lot of people that are really passionate about keeping it. And the fact that we've managed to retain that with all these pressures of one of the densest cities in the country, a few miles away to the north, and development on every other side, flight paths all around, major highways bisecting and surrounding the perimeter of it, and yet we've managed to hold it.
They've managed to hold it, to mostly preserve the mountain's natural state, despite the construction of a major highway in 1968, when developers had big plans to flatten the mountain and to build a neighborhood on it. The area was so notorious for booming development that Malvina Reynolds even wrote this classic song about it.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes on the hillside, little boxes all the same. There's a pink one.
But anyone who's driven by this wild, sloping piece of land can tell you that those plans were never realized. The reason? A people's movement that started in the 1970s. David Schooley was one of its leaders.
And it was oak forest, untouched, just shining oak trees, Islay forest, grasses, everything. This incredible thing right next to the Candlestick. And I went up into Buckeye Canyon, no trail. I just couldn't believe it. That began my whole life.
Shortly after David first saw San Bruno Mountain, 50 years ago, in all its untouched glory, he learned that it would be transformed into a housing development, with stores and apartment buildings constructed for thousands of people. This activated David. He's an environmentalist, and to give you a sense of who he is, David once made a pact never to drive a car. It was his way of protesting the construction of a highway. Decades later, he's kept that promise. And it was with that same passion that he set out to protect San Bruno Mountain.
All of us were horrified because people who lived in Brisbane was the secret because of the oak forest and the wilderness above it.
Alongside community members from Brisbane and environmental organizations like Save the Bay, David helped to start a movement called the Committee to Save San Bruno Mountain to stop the development and fight for a public park.
We want our wild mountain. And this activity began to intensify. And we started going to all the schools, teachers, universities, telling the story about the mountain. The first march on the mountain, which was 500 people marching up the mountain with banners, with statements, and the whole thing.
The movement was successful in blocking much of the planned construction. A 1978 lawsuit was settled with the county taking over about half of the mountain to protect it. A couple years later, the state took over some acres on the mountain's saddle area, a lower elevation point between the peaks. But that's not where this story ends. Developers were still planning to build on the private land.
And this started a whole new war. War number one was the saddle and the people, and then it was the butterflies and the town itself.
The site already had residents, the endangered Mission Blue butterfly and the San Bruno elfin butterfly. They'd been added to the brand new Endangered Species Act in 1976. So their habitat, right where the developers wanted to build, was protected.
We thought, hey, this is a miracle. Number one, we saved the mountain. Now butterflies are going to save the mountain. They're going to stop the builders.
But that's not exactly what happened. Instead, developers were only temporarily stalled. Then, in 1982, the Endangered Species Act was amended to allow for the limited and unintentional take of endangered species. Basically, this means it's legal to build on endangered species habitat with a Habitat Conservation Plan, or HCP, in place. Today, there are several hundred HCPs around the country, but the one on San Bruno Mountain was the first. To people like David, the HCP program is a catastrophic failure.
That shouldn't happen. Rare and endangered species should be given pure care and concern.
But others consider HCPs a necessary compromise and point to the fact that they require landowners to commit to species conservation in order to build. In fact, the reason Evan and his team count butterflies is because of an HCP mandate. Today, the mountain is a patchwork of state, county, and private owners. And as for David's People's Movement, it developed into San Bruno Mountain Watch, an organization that cares for the mountain through ecological restoration and advocacy. But the HCP debate still raises the question. In the Bay Area, where housing is scarce and natural space is beloved, can we fight for both simultaneously?
I think they're inextricably tied together and linked together.
That's Jordan Grimes. He works on state and regional housing policy with Greenbelt Alliance, an environmental and housing nonprofit. And he also lives in San Mateo County.
We cannot solve our climate crisis without solving our housing crisis, and vice versa. Both things are wrapped up in how we use our land. It's the single most important thing affecting the Bay Area today.
To Jordan, the framing of conservation versus housing development is problematic. Instead, he says we need to build in a very different way, more densely and in existing urban areas.
We need to embrace infill and embrace building taller and denser in our existing cities so that that butterfly can continue to exist and so that person doesn't end up on the street.
In San Mateo, this would mean loosening zoning barriers to allow for higher and denser buildings. And it means that not everybody would get their own private patch of green space. Jordan sees this proposed change in mindset around how we live as a way to protect open space, like San Bruno Mountain.
And so for me, enjoying time on San Bruno Mountain sort of means looking down at the rest of the county, looking across the rest of the county, and seeing how much potential and how much work we still have to do. We have a responsibility to accommodate people in a sustainable way.
And we have a responsibility to care for precious open space. In addition to four species of endangered or threatened butterflies on the mountain, it's also home to a dozen rare and endangered plant species. Back on the mountain, we're looking for signs of the elfin.
And you can often see some windowing, we call it, which is kind of like places where they've been chewing on it and the leaf becomes kind of transparent, kind of forming a window. And so that gives you a sign that there are larvae here that you can find.
And then, the reason we've come here today.
See on the tip of the flower there?
This
juicy little grub?
Yeah.
They have kind of like a nice striping pattern when they get larger like that.
On top of a spring green succulent with little yellow flowers, we find a tiny red caterpillar. Despite some habitat degradation on the mountain, Evan's team counted over 1,000 elfin larvae this year, similar to the previous two counts. If these elfins survive, they'll enter a hibernation-like state, and in February, emerge as butterflies. In San Mateo, I'm Julia Haney for Cross Currents.
Thanks, Julia. And if you're interested in a guided hike of San Bruno Mountain, we'll show you how at klw.org/crosscurrents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. Butterflies can help preserve a mountain, but pins, needles, and some rubbing alcohol can preserve the butterflies. In the basement of the Life Sciences building at UC Berkeley, there's a little-known museum that's home to millions of dried bugs. It's a research collection, and it's growing, with new specimens filed away every day. So what happens there, and what is it like? In 2016, we sent reporter Mary Lee Williams there to find out.
Okay, what we can see is just columns and columns of wooden drawers.
That's Peter Obojski. He's the collections manager for the Essex Museum of Entomology. And tucked away in those wooden drawers are his specimens, roughly 6 million of them.
I have some examples right over here we can take a look at.
Oh my goodness. Oh my God. Those are massive.
They're dead. Don't worry.
Oh my God. Those are the biggest bugs I have ever seen.
We're looking in a drawer filled with giant, shiny beetles, part of what's called the Oh My collection, which showcases large, flashy insects. One is about the size of my iPhone.
Put this drawer back up here.
They're freaky big, but they're also kind of pretty.
The way they're displayed, every leg, every segment of the antennae are very carefully arranged, and that is because the people who collected these are beetle enthusiasts.
Yes, beetle enthusiasts. Amateur insect collectors who spend their free time capturing and delicately preserving these bugs.
And every specimen to them has to be a work of art.
Sometimes the beetle fans donate their treasures to the museum. But a lot of the collection comes from research projects. After students or professors conduct a study, they have to put their specimens somewhere.
It's a repository for people's research.
So what's now called the Essig Museum opened in 1939. But some of the insects predate the museum, going back hundreds of years. It even has ground beetles from one well-known beetle enthusiast, Charles Darwin.
Those were specimens he collected while on the voyage of the Beagle to Tierra del Fuego.
Darwin's beetles are tiny, maybe half an inch, very different from the Theraphosa blondii, which is also part of the Oh My collection.
Oh my God! Oh my God!
Commonly known as the Goliath Bird Eater.
Oh, that's so terrifying!
It's the largest spider in the world. Open your hand and spread out your fingers. The bird eater is about that big.
So the name is suggestive of something pretty spectacular, jumping out of trees and catching birds, but actually they're eating chicks and nests.
But you can't just pop by to see this giant spider. The Essig Museum of Entomology isn't open to the public. One reason is there isn't enough space.
So where I have the displays for some of our events is the same place I do all my work. So the option is work or talk to the public. I can't do both at the same time.
Most of the work that happens here isn't on the Goliath level. It's more like flies and bedbugs.
So I'm having a great time getting back in touch with my bugs.
That's Paul Rude. He studied entomology at Berkeley in 1980, but left the field to work as a general contractor. About a year and a half ago, he started volunteering here.
Really, all I'm doing is I'm taking these out one by one. I'm taking this fly out, and then I'm putting it under the microscope.
He is chipping away at a backlog of uncatalogued flies called Diptera.
What I'm looking for is particular indications of whether it belongs to certain groups.
When he figures that out, he drops each fly into the proper drawer and gets another. Rude's been into bugs since he was a kid. He started by collecting butterflies. When he ran out of those, he branched out to flies.
You know, from a distance, they all look the same, and who cares? But when you take the time to look at them individually, you'll find they're extremely bizarre. Many of them have very odd features and different colors.
Most volunteers, like Rude, want to focus on a certain insect or kind of task, sorting scorpion flies, say, or pinning specimens. Peter Obojski, the collections manager, studies small moths from Pacific Islands. But he says his focus doesn't matter. He likes learning about insects.
That's why I love working in the museum, it's a collection of stories. There's a story in every drawer, and I find that fascinating.
That means researchers like Obojski could discover a new species of bedbug or find a now extinct butterfly that's perfectly preserved, depending on which drawer they open. For Cross Currents, I'm Mary Lee Williams.
That story first aired in 2016. Today, Peter Obojski is executive director of the Essig Museum. We've got more information and pictures of dead bugs at kalw.org/crosscurrents. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Now we'll hear from some folks that capture nature, not by using pins, but pens. It's New Arrivals, our pocket-sized book tour with Bay Area authors. And today we're featuring three writers whose work centers around the great outdoors. First, Jason Roberts, who lives in Oakland. His book is called Every Living Thing: The Great and Deadly Race to Know All Life.
It's about one of the most important rivalries in history, a rivalry that shaped the nature of our relationship to the natural world, to nature itself. Here's a passage. Both Buffon and Linnaeus had been born in 1707. Both devoted themselves to compiling a massive work intended to capture the whole of nature, and neither had succeeded. But there, the resemblance ended. To Linnaeus's mind, nature was a noun. All species remained as created during Genesis, representing an unchanging tableau. To Buffon, nature was a verb, a swirl of constant change. To Linnaeus, classification was knowledge. How could life be understood without organizing it into tidy categories? Buffon believed that to classify was to oversimplify, that while useful for practical purposes, classification ran the risk of embedding fundamental misunderstandings. Linnaeus believed a single specimen could exemplify the species it belonged to, displaying a distinguishing essence. Buffon thought species were far more fluid, and that unknown forces connected them across an expanse of time.
That was Jason Roberts reading from his book, Every Living Thing. It came out in April. California is full of conflicts over nature, and one of the most contentious is around water. Next, Berkeley author Stephen Most reads from the updated second edition of his book, River of Renewal: Myth and History in the Klamath Basin.
My book tells the story of the largest dam removal and watershed restoration project in history. Here's an excerpt. The tribes were determined to succeed, no matter what the obstacles. As Craig Tucker saw, other Americans are used to going to a place, exploiting the hell out of it, leaving behind a mess, and we just go to the next place. For Native people the world over, it doesn't work that way. They believe they're put on a place to take care of it. They're not going to kill all the salmon and go off to the next river. That's not it. During the Chadwick groups and Pacific Corps meetings, tribal leaders managed to have difficult discussions with farmers and other regional stakeholders. They had personal conversations and built some trust. But a formidable upriver struggle lay ahead. Could a basin-wide alliance be formed? If there were an alliance, could it get support from state and federal governments for dam removal? And if that happened, could their combined political pressure make Warren Buffett free the Klamath River from his four hydroelectric dams?
That was Stephen Most reading from his book, River of Renewal. It came out in October. Our last featured author takes a lighter look at nature. Jeff Miller splits his time between Ashland, Oregon, and the Bay Area. His book is Bay Area Wildlife, An Irreverent Guide.
It's an informative, entertaining, and salacious guide that will make you fall in love with the most interesting and unusual wild animals that can be found in the greater San Francisco Bay Area. Full of stories about fascinating animal behaviors and impressive congregations of critters, and intended as an antidote to dry nature guides and scholarly ecology publications. This is an excerpt from my chapter on the loggerhead shrike. Behold the butcher bird, a compact black mass killer that only weighs as much as two AA batteries and belies its small stature with an outsized murderous habit of impaling its prey on spikes. Its predatory nature is unusual for a songbird, earning the loggerhead shrike the title of honorary raptor. Where shrikes hunt the grasslands, small animals end their lives skewered onto thorns or barbed wire fences. Because they lack large talons for grasping or tearing, shrikes resort to impaling insects, lizards, small mammals, or tiny birds for easy dining, or to save for later. thus the nicknames Butcher Bird or Thorn Bird. Caches of speared food come in handy for shrikes during breeding season when they need extra energy, or in winter when prey is scarce. An industrious shrike can turn a barbed wire fence into a gruesome art installation. I call this one Still Life with Lizard, and my latest work over there is Mouse Decomposing.
That was Jeff Miller reading from his book, Bay Area Wildlife, An Irreverent Guide. It came out this month. New Arrivals is produced by Lisa Morehouse, and there's many more where that came from. Find readings by local authors by subscribing to the New Arrivals podcast. And before you go, if you have ever wondered what it's like behind the scenes of our show, well, you can join us for Cross Currents Live this Friday. I'll be hosting a night of storytelling, poetry, dance, and music. And it's a chance to experience your favorite Cross Currents features, plus pizza from our friends at Joy Ride Pizza and Drinks. Please come connect with us at Cross Currents Live. That's this Friday, November 22nd at 220 Montgomery in downtown San Francisco. We'll show you how to get some tickets at klw.org/events. And I hope to see you there. Today's Cross Currents team includes James Rollins, Ganadi Joe Johnson, Truk Nguyen, Victor Kentz, Molly Blair Salier, Shirin Adil, Hanisha Harjani, Marissa Ortega Welch, Angela Johnston, Sunni Khalid, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.